from the creation of plantations and the birth of the Industrial Revolution to slavery and mass migration. Is colonialism to blame for the dire situation we face with climate change? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the programme. I'm Adrian Finnegan. An exhibition looking at the legacy of colonialism and the role that it played in the birth of climate change has opened in London. 11 artists with a personal connection to Africa, the Caribbean and South America have pinpointed environmental change as a racial process with deep roots in colonial history. Through this collection of artworks, the overlapping crises of environmental damage and colonialism are put under scrutiny. Al Jazeera's Jessica Baldwin has been to have a look.
Mountains of sugar piled high in a French warehouse. Harvested in sugarcane plantations across the globe, the sweet cargo travels thousands of kilometers to feed Europe. It's a pattern of trade dating back hundreds of years. And as this exhibition argues, that history holds the roots of current climate change. We Are History challenges visitors to take a different perspective, to go back in time to when European nations colonized much of the world, extracting natural resources, forcing millions into slavery, and setting up the plantation system.
From the colonial period onwards, we had these patterns of movements of ships, movements of people, movements of product, movements of commerce, movements of communications, if we want to understand what climate change looks like and how we've brought that about. As a human species, we can look at our practices across hundreds of years.
Works by artists with a personal connection to the developing world trace the link between empire building and pillaging of the land and the native people. Drawings by Dutch sailors celebrating the plentiful as they arrived in Africa, where their large-scale plunder left a number of animals extinct. The archive photograph of young men and a boy piloting their canoe in Madagascar seeks to redignify the subjects, not a docile group. The black braid surrounding the hanging speaks to the enslaved people working together to resist as best they could, be resilient, and to survive.
We stand as a testament to that survival. And I think, you know, we live within, you know, globalized systems that still use these extractive practices. And so actually for the majority of people out there, they don't, they, you know, the economics of the plantation haven't really gone away.
The show is in a colonial era building. Somerset House was the headquarters for the British Navy, the power Britain relied on to rule a large part of the world.
The global trade patterns of that empire persist. Poorly paid factory workers in the developing world providing cheap goods to consumers in the north. Jessica Baldwin, Al Jazeera, London.
Well, we'll introduce you to our panel in just a moment, but first, let's take a look into the background surrounding climate change and links to colonialism. The first evidence of man-made climate change dates back to the early days of the Industrial Revolution in the 1800s. That's when mass manufacturing was born. It went hand in hand with colonialism, as Western nations used slave labour in large-scale farming and to extract raw materials. Industrialised countries grew their economies by burning fossil fuels. Many scientists believe that those emissions led to an increase in the planet's average temperature around the year 1830. Created by practices born of a colonial mindset to create wealth, climate change has become one of our most pressing threats. And fittingly, next week, the UN Climate Summit will bring governments together in Scotland to decide the goals of the Paris Agreement. So let's bring in our guests. In London, we have with us Echo Eshan. He's the curator of that exhibition we were hearing about just a few moments ago, We Are History. And from Hamburg, Jürgen Zimmerer. He's a professor at the University of Hamburg, focusing on colonialism, genocide, Africa and post-colonial memory. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Echo, let's start with you. Tell us more about the thinking behind this exhibition, its aims, how you went about selecting the artists, and what their work is saying to us.
Well, look, the exhibition, as you've heard, We Are History, is at Somerset House in London. It's a group exhibition with nine artists whose personal origins lie in the global south, in Africa, the Caribbean, South America, and who as artists have individually, through their work, I think, been exploring these quite complex legacies and relationships between colonialism and climate change. They do that through a range of different practices in terms of photography, film, tapestry, a whole range. But the main issue, I think, and the main issue, I suppose, of the exhibition as a whole, is to, I think, try and expand some of our discourse and discussion around what we think of, what we talk about, what we see when we discuss climate change. So conventionally, we think of climate change as something really that kind of belongs to the Northern Hemisphere, that is a modern outcome, perhaps, of the Industrial Revolution, or even more recently. The artists in this exhibition and the exhibition as a whole suggest that if we really want to understand the beginnings and the origins of how we got to where we are right now as a planet, we have to go back, in fact, to the 16th century, to the 17th century, to the beginnings of colonialism, when you got the first large-scale mass movements of people around the planet, forced migrations through slavery, when you got large-scale shifts in environment as a consequence of plantation, agriculture, monocrop agriculture, when you got the rise of extractive mining practices in terms of gold mining and so on.
Yeah.
All of these are put in.
Echo,
in the beginning of colonialism.
Echo, as you say, it explores the complex legacies of colonialism. But why should people care? What's the relevance to now as we face the climate emergency that we currently are facing?
I think if we want to really grapple with or grasp or even understand or engage with the really existential questions of climate change, I think it helps if we can figure out how to tell stories, how to have narratives that we can understand. And most of those narratives that we live with currently are confined to the Northern Hemisphere. So we think of climate change, we think perhaps of an image of a slightly forlorn-looking polar bear on a shrinking piece of ice. This exhibition and the work of these artists, I think, offers some new ways of looking and some new ways of thinking about climate change by looking through the perspectives of people in the developing world, by suggesting, in fact, that the ways of engaging with nature that people in the global south, different indigenous communities have had for centuries, for generations, for aeons, offer us some ways of both treasuring nature, understanding its fragility and its fraughtness, and thinking about how environments and climates in the developing world are being affected profoundly by climate change. I think this is about expanding some of our frame of reference and our discussion.
Jürgen, to what extent is today's climate emergency due to an ongoing form of colonialism with, you're thinking about huge corporations polluting, exploiting workers, pillaging the planet's mineral wealth?
Well, to a great deal. Of course, we have a political decolonization in the 1960s, but we never had an economic decolonization. And a lot of the economic structures in which the globalized world is operating stem from the colonial globalization. So we have to take this into account, and we need to decolonize not only our museums, something which is important topic at the moment in Europe, but we have to decolonize our structures. We have to decolonize our economic system. We have to decolonize our way of living, basically. We are facing a existential threat, or the most existential threat humanity ever has faced, and we really need to decolonize our way of looking at the world and our narratives and basically everything.
Jürgen, we started then our discussion with the exhibition in London and the interrelations between today's climate emergency and the legacies of colonialism. How important do you think it is that the people acknowledge that connection?
I think we need to acknowledge this, and that was my starting point into starting research and thinking about this topic, was to say, how did we get where we are? This is through colonial globalization. And why are we, the people in the global north, completely unable to really understand this existential threat and to act accordingly? And I think both is linked. For 600 years, Europeans used up more resources than they produced on their own and what would have been their normal share per capita. And not only did we get into the mess which we are now through this capitalist system, which is based on growth and consumption, it also makes us in the global north unable to address the issue properly, because we also learned over 600 years that we got away with. Because the people who suffered from this resource extraction, from this overuse and overconsumption of resources, were the people in the global north. And now, when it hits closer to home to us, we are unable, and we still think it's not serious, we get away with it, we just need a technical fix, because we can't imagine that it's not working out, because it worked out for us for 600 years.
As you probably saw just a few moments ago, we've been joined by a third guest. Stefan Singer is from the Climate Action Network International. He's a senior climate science and global energy policy advisor. He's with us now from Brussels. Stefan, really good to have you with us. Does identifying the beginnings of climate change, as we have been talking about here, help us deal with the current climate emergency?
If you look into decolonization in a context of climate change, you need to look into that we have the rich middle classes, mainly of the north, but increasingly also of the south, and the upper class, of course, have colonized the space with CO2 emissions, which stay there for up to 1,000 years, and which cause climate change in the atmospheric sense. So that's the way what we need to deal with to pay back our ecological debt in one way or the other. I wouldn't say it's limited to the north. It includes also increasingly the middle classes and the rich classes of the south, which cannot hide behind the north only and always. And this is something we are addressing internally, Climate Action Network. But nevertheless, the majority of the emissions, in this case is carbon dioxide emissions from burning fossil fuels, comes from the classical rich northern nations like the UK, the US, Germany, Russia, Japan, and a couple of others. But this is this kind of, if you want to call it advantage or leadership, negative leadership, is being fading away, because we're going to be taken up by the middle classes and the rich classes of India, China, South Africa, and others.
Right.
I think we need to be aware that we have a common understanding that we need to decolonize in the context of climate change. Carbon legacy in the atmosphere.
Stephanie, you talked about paying back. I think the public these days understands that climate change is real. That argument is one, right? And people, I think it's fairly safe to say, are worried. Does the public, though, understand the costs involved in fixing the problems? I mean, polluters should pay, of course, but what about the public?
Well, I don't know what the public are thinking. I'm coming from a scientific perspective. And I think that most people would understand that you have a responsibility. That's a precautionary principle. You have caused something, you have to pay for repairing it in one way or the other. So we need to reduce significantly our emissions. I think that's a common understanding. And even that is not a given thing, given the status of our climate. But the second thing is, how do we repair for the losses and damages that occur in the south, developing countries, frontline communities, but also increasingly in the north? So that is something what we have to do as well, to pay for leverage money, finances, for paying those communities to do adapt to climate change, build resilience, and simply pay for loss and damages. After adaptation, loss and damages coming in a big way. And this will be one of our priorities for the upcoming climate conference in Glasgow.
Which we'll get on to in just a moment. But, Jürgen, I saw you shaking your head a few moments ago. I'm not sure whether that was in disagreement or agreement. But do you want to pick up on what Stefan was saying there?
Yeah, I think Stefan is right, but it's not enough to pay compensation or reparation or whatever for local communities. I mean, the colonial globalization has shown that we have an ever more unequal distribution of wealth on the globe. And in order, and we are in a double bind, because in the north we say, okay, we are ready for zero emission in the future and keep our level of comfort, our way of living. But that won't be possible, because the large part of the globe also has a right to increase their standards of living and their consumptive level. So we need global social justice, and that means that we need actually to lower our living standard in the global north in order to allow the global south to get some increase in their wealth. I mean, the Stefan was right to say this is also a point now for the elite in the global south and the middle classes, which also need to adapt. But on a global level, we need a reduction, a lowering of our living standards in the north, and we to allow others to grow and increase their consumption level. And that is something which we need to tell our people, and nobody really wants to tell. Everybody hopes for a global fix, and as a technical fix. And as I said, that is because we are used to it. Because over 600 years, whenever we needed more resources, we went somewhere else and got the resources there. And in science fiction, we now are not only in science fiction, we talk about the colonization of the moon or the Mars, which is just a continuation of this narrative that we can increase consumption endlessly. But the simple fact is we can't. And that is something which we need to tell the people.
And Eko, I'll come back to you in just a moment. But Jürgen, I just want to ask you a question about the mindset that allows people in one part of the world to live beyond their fair share of resources at the expense of others. Globalization as a form of colonialism.
Yeah, I mean, that is my observation when I see that people, even in Germany, which are quite sensitive about climate change, still think that they can just go on living the way they used to live, and always say, because we will find a way forward, and that they are in denial. In denial of the way Germany, Europe has acquired its riches, and in denial of the consequences of this climate emergency. And I think it's time to really tell the truth, and we need to think ahead and find a new way, a global social justice approach to this. And on a global scale, to say we have to change basically everything in order to survive this emergency.
Eko, as you said, this exhibition is made up of work mainly from artists from the global south. In what ways has the legacy of colonialism and its impact on climate change affected their work?
I mean, it runs entirely through their work. Their work has a politics to it, because inbuilt into the photographs or the films or the tapestries they make, there's a clear awareness of social injustice and inequities between the North and South. But also their work has a poetry to it, has a visual poetry to it, because their work is deeply embedded in working from the perspectives of people and places and communities and memories within South America, the Caribbean, Africa, which is to say that one of the ways potentially that we can start to affect some of these shifts that your other speakers are talking about is through an expansion of our own imaginative reach
is through being able to see through the eyes of other people and perhaps reach closer to a sense and an understanding of what's at stake, of the beauty and preciousness of the natural world in different parts of the world, of the climates and of the peoples and of those environments. So an understanding that these legacies are in play isn't just a lamenting, it's also a way of saying, look, let's shift our perspective, let's expand our imaginative reach in order both to understand what's at stake, but also to recognize that there are more possibilities in play about how we can talk about, how we can think about climate change, and as a consequence, how we might start to converse differently about that.
Stefan, as you pointed out, this exhibition opens ahead of the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow with progress on the 2015 Paris Agreement still lagging. I mean, what are the chances of COP26 actually being anything more than just a talking shop that results in more empty promises?
I don't know, to be very honest. I think Boris Johnson makes a good job on hyping it up and making it a propaganda show. And it will be one of the COPs which might end up in nice commitments on the paper and then take dust on the shelf, but nothing which is materializable, which is granular and precise, unfortunately. We had a couple of good COPs in the past, starting from Kyoto, going to Paris, but most of the COPs have been just empty papers, unfortunately. That doesn't speak against multilateral agreements and multilateral get-together. I think we have to go through that one. But I think the real fight is on the ground. The real fight is not in these COPs. And this is on the regions, it's in the cities, it's in the countries and the parliaments. That's where the commitments are being done, where the implementation is to be agreed. I think we need to be clear about this one. Yeah, let me say one thing about the overall, and I might be a little bit exaggerating here, the understanding that we have to tell our people in our rich countries, supposedly rich countries, they all have to give up their living standards to reduce their living standards. I think that's a very detrimental approach. I think we need to differentiate whom we are asking that one. I think we need to go for, and I'm coming from a social justice movement. I'm a trade unionist. I'm a socialist for many years. And I think we need to really, really differentiate and tell the public there are certain folks, certain classes who benefit from the current situation, who benefit from the failure of the state to address taxes and equity, and others who are suffering. We have in Germany, was mentioned, we have in Germany about 30% in poverty who are working. The increase of the minimum wages now from 9 euro to 12 euro in Germany, which might be coming up with a new coalition, affects 37% of the population. So 37% of the population have a wage per hour which is less than 12 euro. Mm.
Jürgen, I need a very quick answer from you. Your comments, your thoughts on that. Britain's Queen Elizabeth this week was overheard expressing her frustration with the politicians, being all talk and no action. What are your thoughts on COP26?
Well, she is right. And if COP26 doesn't do away with the ideology of growth and consumption, then it's failing, because that's what we need them to tell us, that the ideology of growth led to this disaster, and with this ideology in place, we can't sort it out.
Okay. There, gentlemen, I'm afraid we're going to have to end it. We're out of time. Many thanks indeed for being with us. Eko Eschen, Jürgen Zimmermann, and Stefan Singer. And as always, thank you for watching. Don't forget you can see the programme again at any time just by going to the website at aljazeera.com. For further discussion, join us at our Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/AJInsideStory. And you can join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle at AJInsideStory. From me, Adrian Finnegan, and the whole team here in Doha. Thanks for watching. We'll see you again. Bye for now.